You're listening to Niche to Meet You, the audio project about little-known niche subcultures and hobbies where we make our meaning. On this episode, three wildly different niche subcultures who all find their purpose in being on the road. I'm Leslie, and it's Niche to Meet You. There's a concept I've come to know of in sociology. It's about the different environments or places we find ourselves. The first space is our home. The second space is where we might work, and then there are third spaces. The term originated with a 1989 book by Ray Oldenburg called Good Place. The subtitle actually gives us examples of these third spaces: cafes, coffee shops, bookstores, bars, hair salons, and other hangouts at the heart of a community. They offer belonging and share common characteristics. They're typically cozy and unpretentious. They're level playing fields, not dependent on status in society. There are regulars who foster a playful mood, and folks in these spaces feel a sense of home when they're there. You might know of a third space of your own, where everybody knows your name, which, you know, it's the theme song of a famous third place, the Cheers Bar. Central Perk from Friends is another one, or Group Study Room F in Community. Despite the continued presence of third spaces in current media, the third space itself is disappearing. Think about malls or the significance of libraries. Remote work has let us combine the first two spaces, and social media and platforms like Marco Polo are filling our social time. Cost of living is another concern, where the places with central gathering spots are becoming more expensive. This is another reason why hobbies and niche subcultures are pretty important to help combat a loneliness epidemic. But what about those people whose spaces, all three of them sometimes, are transient? Whose work takes them elsewhere, which means they live in different places at different times? Where do these people find their third places, and what kinds of hobbies become available to them? Or what about the folks for whom their third space isn't a single space at all, but that goes where they go? In our first mini-series about Warhammer 40,000, we met Aaron, whose traveling job in construction left him feeling lonely and disconnected when COVID left him isolated in one place for an extended period of time.
I was stuck in one area for about 6 months straight, but when I got into 40K, it kind of helped me de-stress, basically. It's whenever I'm on the road, depending on where I go, I will usually take some sets of models with me so I can actually try and get a game in. So it works out in the end.
Through Warhammer 40,000, and if you haven't listened to the miniseries about 40K, you know, I think you should, Aaron is able to find a new way to foster a third space no matter where he goes. Kind of like a North Star for an ever-changing sky. Similarly, touring musicians like Zach and Maggie White have the same problem. And they came up with a construct for orienting themselves in a new space when they're on the road.
Well, you know, typically we only have a couple hours before a show that we can experience something. So the things that you look to do to actually experience a unique location are
flora, fauna, folks, food.
Brilliant.
And so that kind of started by listening to, we realized that we go to different places. And of course, we already knew that we'd try whatever local food there was, but we would also realize, I've never heard that bird before. There's really about four things that you always notice that can be different in every location.
This experience of exploring the spaces they inhabit for only several hours at a time led them to a hobby they take up when they're home for longer stretches. They call it regional cooking, which Maggie describes as
the way that you cook around a region. So like if I go to the grocery store and I'm getting all the ingredients for tostadas, then probably everything we cook that week is going to have some sort of Mexican flair. Or if I'm going more Italian, you know, if I'm cooking a pasta, then probably everything that week is going to be more Italian. Some weeks are more successful than others.
But right.
For them, the experience of their transient third space has given way to a new understanding of their second space, their home, and what they eat in it.
Heck, this past year and a half has been a real healthy year for me of like lost 70 something pounds while eating kind of whatever I wanted, just less of it. But it was by understanding how to cook and have a broader spectrum and understanding of what makes stuff up that we could be more flexible with our food, be less wasteful. It just becomes this compounding thing. But understanding all that, the fun way has been through travel and through culture to understand it. And then that also allows you to waste less and have less rotted stuff at the end of the week.
I experienced this firsthand in their kitchen when they made me what they call a kimchi omelet. It's something they made up, and it's a combination of Korean and Mexican cuisine. It was based on something they ate at a food truck they found in L.A., run by a famous chef named Roy Choi.
So Roy Choi created a kogi, which was a food truck that was Korean taco truck. So it's Korean flavors in kind of Mexican taco style forms. Yeah. We had a kimchi quesadilla.
So after arriving home from that stretch on the road, their fridge was basically empty.
We didn't have any groceries, but I saw kimchi in the fridge and I saw eggs. And I said, a kimchi omelet sounds good, which I would have totally just like stopped there with just eggs and kimchi. And then he made this whole thing that we're going to have today.
First, Zach mixes the sauce. He starts with soy sauce, but then he adds a host of other ingredients.
I'm just gonna squeeze just a tiny bit of this sauce we'll put on there.
So that's the mixture.
So that's a mixture with some other things that are from all over that don't technically go together by regional tradition, but also totally go together.
Then he mixes the eggs and pours them into the hot pad. Then he adds the kimchi.
So now.
So that this is kimchi here?
That's just kimchi.
And then it was time to taste it.
There you go.
Wow. This is for me?
That's for you, yeah.
And you know what? It was really good.
Oh my goodness. I like never taste these tastes.
Isn't it crazy? It's just a fun concoction of like, it's familiar but not at the exact same time.
So this experience in a new locale, had at a third space they may never go to again, has given them a thing to come back to again and again in the shape of a hobby. Their own niche subculture. But if we follow the four-legged principle of the perfect hobby that was built for us in the first miniseries of the show, that hobbies have craft, skill, external thought, and community, we might be tempted to think of something like regional cooking as a hobby done in isolation. And it well may be. But food naturally causes us to invite others in, which is what happened with Zach and Maggie.
On a trip to Amsterdam, we had one of the street stroopwafels, the little kind of thin waffles with a bit of caramel in between. You get them on like Delta flights and those prepackaged things. But when we had them there, we went, this tastes so much better. It was much more spiced. They add a lot of kind of the traditional Christmas spices, nutmeg, cinnamon, clove. And it was such a delightful thing to kind of watch someone make it. They're very fast to make. We thought, man, that would make a great get together or an excuse to get together. And when 2020 happened, we decided, hey, let's do it. It's a big outdoor event. It's fall. This feels like the right thing. And we just had our fourth annual Stroopwafel Day. It's one snippet from our life. So like there's a personal side and we remember that trip. Mm-hmm. It was the tail end of this fun vacation before a work trip. But then, now we get to bring it home and share with people.
It's as if the times they're barely able to experience their surroundings can be digested, no pun intended, by sharing the culture they enjoy with the folks back home too. They're even considering starting a supper club for the times they're in town. But work travel makes this hard, so to share this hobby of theirs while they travel, they've made a cookbook, pairing recipes with songs on their album. Like, for example, a delicious dessert made with bananas they've named Bring a Banoffee. It pairs with their song, Bring a Banana. And then there's this recipe.
Bologna and white sauce. Which is a gross sound.
It doesn't sound good, but it tastes amazing.
This dish accompanies a song called Family Tree. It's a tune that was inspired by Zach learning that distant generations of his family, the Whites, lived in the same town as Maggie's distant relatives. And apparently, her family is a big fan of this dish.
So, you grew up having it.
Yeah. Fried bologna and then a white gravy. And it is spectacular.
I will just have to take her word for that. But what about the folks for whom the first and second places, home and work, adapt to fit the needs of their third space? Folks like Spencer Waddell, who's, I'm not kidding, The nicest guy you'll ever meet.
What's funny, Spencer, is I don't know if anyone who met you outside of what you do would know that you do what you do.
No, it's very true. I've been that one kid that's always like wanting to be everybody's friend. And it's funny that we talk about this in the light of Akira Toriyama passing, the creator of Dragon Ball Z, which I'm wearing my little Saiyan shirt. Like with
and that's a Dragon Ball Z character that you're wearing?
Yeah, it's a Dragon Ball Z character. His name is Goku. But he's really easy-go-lucky, kind of having meeting friends.
But you relate to that character.
I super do. And like the whole always pushing yourself to your limits, trying to meet new people and being stronger and just having fun through fighting.
When Spencer says fighting, he means with swords. Spencer is a vagabond longswordsman, one of the best in the world. But that's not all he does. He's a trained stuntman, founder of a nonprofit that teaches about swords and fighting, travels around the world to do steel fighting. He does African martial arts, European martial arts, reenactments, and competitions. Like a recent fight at the Arnold Sports Festival in Columbus, Ohio, at which Arnold Schwarzenegger himself, Conan the Barbarian, knighted the champion.
So he shook Sam's hand, and Sam was just talking to me like, oh, you're just such a my hero, like Conan, talking about Aquila, all these things. He's like, would you knight me? And I hear him say, absolutely. And he hands him the sword, that's why he kneels. And I was just like,
so perfect.
And that helps bring some more claim to our game, which it's all about making the connections through whatever way happens so we can bring more acclaim to the sport and just show people what it is.
The seeds for this lifestyle were planted in Spencer at a young age.
Growing up as a kid, I just go in the backyard and play with sticks like my friends. Like, and we hit each other with sticks and pretend to do sword fighting. And that's the start right there.
From there, Spencer started taking karate and other martial arts in his teenage years. Then he joined the military.
I was stationed in Ramstein, Germany. So, you know, Europe. Castles. I remember going to Heidelberg Castle for the first time and actually seeing a castle in a town. But that's how I started doing some historical sword work there, some German style, some other, which would be HEMA, historical European martial arts, and learning that. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool.
So when he came back to the States, Spencer trained with folks who traveled all across the world to do reenactments. And for him, this is where his love of the stuff took off.
It's just so cool to be able to walk these lifestyles or watch this history, actual human history, or if you want to just find out the swords of weaponry and actually understand what the people did back then, but then also share it. Like I had a chance to go to Greece. It was the 2500th anniversary of the Battle of Plataea. And we went to the place in Greece. We actually were wearing what they would have worn. We marched. I was wearing Greek sandals. It was in the heat. The first day we got there, it was like 102 degrees. We camped out there for a good week and a half, maybe. And then we went on some marches. One of the places that was too far away, like we got on a bus, had all of us in our gear on a bus, and took us to a place where there's now a big giant field where they would have met up 2,500 years ago. And I remember, like, people from the local village would come, like, there's this father and two girls, and they come and take pictures with us. And one day, I had this like little ring, this little banded copper ring that I'd make and I'd give them away. And I gave one to one little girl, and the father put his hand on my shoulder and was like, I'll make sure they remember this for the rest of their life.
What about that was so meaningful to them, do you think?
I don't know. I think that they were just like, oh, this person gave me something that they made for me. And it's that taking that time and making that real life human connection. And it's not forced. Like, I'm not like, oh, I need to do something so I have a story to tell. It's about making other people's environments or experiences special. And that's what really draws me to this, because things like that, or when I went to the Arnold's and telling people that they could do this too, we can get them in contact with different gyms or all these things, just making people believe in themselves and either strive for greatness or strive for happiness. Yeah, I think that's really what it comes down to.
Spencer's hobby, or maybe more appropriately called lifestyle, gives him purpose that drives everything else. And it helps him connect with people and their own histories all over the world. But he doesn't have a central location. In fact, we had to coordinate our interview for a time when he was in a spot with internet. His life truly revolves around the subculture in which he finds meaning and belonging.
It's really always been about what I want to do and everything else. But people are like, but that's real life and fantasy. I'm like, well, that's why I made it a part of my real life. It's not all about the large story. It's about the lifestyle that I enjoy. And it's really interesting that this world could bring so many people together. And it's just really fun because who doesn't want to be a knight in shining armor or help a knight in shining armor or go on adventures with knights in shining armor? There's lots of things to work. And if you want to be a part of it, that's the way to be a part of it.
For Zach and Maggie and Spencer, the third space and their niche subcultures where they find community and belonging, these things are far and beyond. That's where they begin. But what about for folks whose hobbies and niche subcultures start at home, but are enhanced elsewhere? We meet one such hobbyist, a Rubik's cubing middle schooler, and the rock star who inspired him, after the break. Can I level with you for a second? A lot of shows at this point will tell you to subscribe, rate, and review, and I would love if you subscribed, truly, I'd be honored. But to be honest, the other two don't help me that much. It has to do with like charting and all sorts of things that frankly I'm just not eligible for. But you know what would really, really help? If you texted two friends right now to tell them about this show, that you've been enjoying it and you think they will too. It could literally be something as simple as, hey, I've been enjoying this show, and I think you will too. And you know what I'll do? I'll even play you some music for 15 seconds while you do that, so you don't miss a thing. And if you're driving, please don't do this, but maybe wait until you're done. Okay, here's the music, and we'll get right back to the episode.
It's called a square one. Okay. And so it like shape shifts. So you see how it's like not always in the cube shape?
This is Shook. He's 10. And that tapping you hear, it's a Rubik's cube. You'll hear it a lot during this portion of the interview. And it's not because he's bored of our conversation or disinterested. In fact, he was really excited to tell me about cubing. No, he's constantly working the cube because the entire activity relies on the ability to recognize shapes and patterns and recall the series of moves called an algorithm to fix it and to do the thing without even thinking about it.
So it's not just that you know the algorithms, it's that
yep.
your fingers are working fast and you're yep. used to them working mm-hmm. that fast?
You have to be able to recognize patterns super quickly. And there's some algorithms that just like they can solve it just immediately.
And that's muscle memory.
Yeah,
it's you're muscle drawing memory. On your muscles mm-hmm. to solve it.
Yeah, like practice, that's the biggest thing you can get. And so it's just, if you practice for a huge amount of time, you can get to Max Park because he knows similar algorithms to what I know, uh-huh. but he's practiced for a lot of time. So
it's Max Park, by the way, is speed cubing legend. He's the central figure in a wildly popular 2020 Netflix documentary about the activity, and he's arguably the best cuber around right now. And Shook, well, he's a big fan.
Max Park, 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 Max Park.
But it's not just Max Park.
Names are a really big deal. Like, you've said a lot of names.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of celebrities in cubing.
Yeah.
For you who's doing it right now, do they like inspire you? Are you motivated by them?
Yeah, kind of, sometimes. Uh-huh. When you watch them solve, like when I watched Luke Garrett solve in person, his fingers were moving so fast, you can't even tell they're moving. 2 seconds later, it's done. And so you just watch them and be like, how do they do that?
Turns out it's not only memorization and muscle memory, but it's memorization, muscle memory, and time to simply focus and zone out while solving a cube over and over, which frankly, makes speed cubing a young person's game. Shook mentioned the name of another cuber featured in the documentary alongside Max, whose name is Felix Zemdix.
At that time, Felix Zemdix was pretty good, but he's getting older now, so he's getting a little rusty.
Do people age out?
Sometimes, yeah. So, like, it's kind of, like, messy where He used to be the best soccer player in the whole entire world.
That's interesting that it happens in cubing, too.
Yeah. It happens in everything. Like, eventually you're going to have to, like, buy a house and find a job and stuff like that. So you just don't have as much time to cube.
It's true. The older we get, the harder it becomes to lose ourselves in something to the point of obsession. This makes the younger years more of a perfect ecosystem for something like cubing to thrive. But to see cubing as an isolating activity would be completely missing the point because, yes, while it can and should be done at all times while at home, it's only understood by traveling to competitions to see others do it better. The competitions are where the thing is truly brought to life.
Basically, you're solving at home, right? But then you add competition. So you do 5 solves, and then your best and worst time get removed.
Ah.
And then your middle 3 solves, they find the average.
So it's not as high pressure as you've got 5 chances to solve it as quick as you can.
Yeah.
So it's not quite as nerve-wracking.
Yeah. You can do like races, like if Max Park's sitting right here in a competition, and then Yi Heng Wang's sitting right here in the competition, and they can just be like, hey, do you want to race? And then they can, like, whoever solves it faster.
Even in the telling of Shook's growing interest in cubing, there are these subtle hints to the community it forms, especially when he finds himself with other folks who have gathered to compete.
It's good to go to competitions because there are a lot of other cubers there, and they can teach you a bunch of stuff. The community is probably the best part of it because you're still solving cubes. You can solve cubes whenever you want at home, but not with, unless you're having a party. You can't do it with a bunch of other cubers from all around the world who have all different times, who know all different algorithms. So it's just, it's really fun to be there.
Seems like even though this is an isolating sort of a thing that you could do for hours and hours on your own, the real joy of it is getting to come together with other people.
Shook's third place, built around the Rubik's Cube, experienced at competitions, really begins in isolation, shutting off from the outside world to immerse and learn. Now, for a new generation of learners, that can begin with YouTube, which is true for Shook. Once he got his first cube as a birthday party favor, he found himself stuck and turned to YouTube to solve it.
I went online and saw this guy named John Schneck. He had a cubing video. And so I watched his cubing videos and then I solved the cube for the first time.
What he found was a series of videos called Cubiversity by John Schneck, who's a friend of his parents. Cubing has a thriving YouTube presence with people teaching algorithms and methods for solving, including John and Cubiversity. But John himself was never a cubing kid like Shook, mostly because the access to information didn't exist.
I remember having one when I was a kid, but there was no YouTube and I didn't know how to do it. There are clearly people who figured out how to do it without a video or instructions or whatever, but I never could solve it. So it was just frustrating.
It wasn't until John became one of those old guys that Shook made mention of that had things like houses and jobs and stuff like that, that he revisited the Rubik's Cube while on the road as the guitarist for a band called Reliant K.
We were somewhere and it was in like a Walgreens. Okay. And I just bought it and it had a DVD that's like Learn to Cube and it was like an official Rubik's Cube. And I was like, I've always wanted to do this. So I literally just laid in my bunk for a couple of days and learned how to do it. But the DVD was terrible. So that's when I got the idea to make Cubiversity.
The idea was this, to teach the algorithms using 8-bit music. John and a couple other friends interested in the cube hadn't seen anything else like it at the time. We're talking 2012. And they made a Kickstarter to support buying equipment to film and record the video content. At first, it was just friends and family who were supporting the project.
And then one day, we were sitting there, and it's just like, because you get notifications on your phone every time you get a backer, and it was just like, ding, 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 ding. And we had become the Kickstarter project of the day. So we got funded that day. Then now it just kind of lives on my YouTube. But the fun thing is every once in a while, someone will come up to me and be like, my kid learned to do the cube from Cubiversity. And I was like, oh, how fun. And 100% of the time, the kids always end up being way better than I am.
Because again, the kids have the benefit of being able to isolate and focus on the cube and learning the solving algorithms and remembering how to implement them and teaching their muscles to move quickly through the movements.
And you lose it too. If you don't cube for a month and you pick it back up, you're like, how do I do this again? It's the same way with me and the guitar. I was a better guitar player when I was 16 years old than I am today. No doubt about it. Because when I was 16, the only thing I wanted to do was play guitar all day long. And now sometimes I will go a month without even picking up a guitar. So yeah, same principle with cubing. They do it 12 hours a day. It's all they do. I never had the goal to be a speed cuber. So cubing is one of those things where if you can walk into a party and there's a Rubik's Cube there and you pick it up and solve it, everyone thinks you're really, really smart. But it's really not that hard to do if you learn how to do it.
John came to the cube while on a boat in a sea of responsibility, or rather, riding the highway of responsibility on a tour bus.
The thing about being a touring musician, from my experience, is, especially in a quote-unquote successful band, is that you have basically 1 hour a day of work. And so when you're on tour, that leaves you with 23 hours a day to not work. So like one thing I did was I finished my marketing degree on the road. So I was like, I have all of this time. I should go to school. So same thing with like Cubiversity, it was, or learning to cube in general. It was just trying to fill the time.
In his attempts to fill the time, John came up with a niche project that's inspiring a new generation of cubers with a lot of time on their hands.
My neighbor, his name was Max, and his dad asked me to teach him how to do the cube. So we started a club, and there were two members. It was me and Max, and we actually made shirts. But anyway, I had this idea that we were going to have like cube meets, and we were going to do this whole thing and maybe even start a chapter and like go to tournaments and stuff. But I remember like a week after I showed Max how to solve it, he came over and he was like in the 20s. And I was just like, and it was that same mentality. It's like, I am getting up every day, getting my kids ready for school, working, coming home, doing house projects, mowing the grass. And Max is sitting in his room. He goes to school and then he comes home and he sits in his room until bedtime and cubes. And I'm like, how did you get so good at this so quickly? And I'm like, oh yeah, it's because it's all you do.
It's been over 10 years since John discovered cubing while a touring musician. And while he's still in the band, they aren't on the road as much as they were back then. The cube goes untouched most days. But as I left his house after the interview, I noticed, placed perfectly in the middle of a built-in bookshelf to the side of the front door, a Rubik's Cube, maybe waiting for a party to be picked up for a trick. When we consider the hobby or a niche, we picture the thing starting where we're planted, in a third space, maybe where we go on a Wednesday night, the places we frequent in the neighborhood, the places where we find belonging. And belonging is a thing that can come from anywhere, even the road. The Niche to Meet You project and the stories we tell within it are lovingly crafted for you by me and my storytelling sidekick, Chris Thiessen. The audio is perfected by Kevin Morris. The theme music you're hearing now is by Abigail Flowers. And the art, the beautiful blue and yellow art, is by Rachel Hardiger. I'm Leslie, and it's been so very niche to meet you.